you have to tell me when you're recording. Welcome to Flicks of Doom, the official movie podcast of Geeks of Doom. I'm Empress Eve, and here with me is my little organic Cheerio, Justin Vactor.
That is correct. Before you go into that, I have to give a shout-out to my favorite Canadian, the movie Moxie, one of our most rabid followers and listeners, because she always lets us know when she's listening. So thank you, and she has a podcast as well. You can find her at Movie Moxie on Twitter.
All right. Yeah, we love her. Movie Moxie! Woo! So, Movie Moxie, get ready for this week, because we'll be talking Paranormal Activity 2, Back to the Future, and this year's Scream Awards. So, Justin, why don't you tell our listeners where they can find us?
After they're searching for Movie Moxie on Twitter, they can go check us out. Flicks of Doom with an X, and they can send us an email, flicksofdoom@gmail.com, or search for us in iTunes if you are not already subscribed, and you can get all the updates whenever there's a new episode. It'll come right into your iTunes player. Also, leave us a review while you're over there, and go to geeksofdoom.com, our official website.
Yeehaw! So, I had a very fun week. With all the events that happened. And so this week, we're not really going to cover much movie news. There was a bunch of movie news. You could go to geeksofdoom.com and check it out. There was updates on the Crow remake and on Disney Christmas special and lots of other things. You could check it all out there. But for now, we want to focus on a very big event. It is my favorite award show of the year. It's the Scream Awards.
Eve, you don't like any award shows. So this wins by default.
Why don't I like any?
That's what I've been trying to figure out.
I don't know what you're even talking about.
Because I love award shows, so I don't know why you don't.
Well,
like
I don't like the ones with music.
Oh, okay.
Because I don't like the music they play. But I like movie award shows like the Oscars and the Golden Globes, but it does not top the Scream Awards as far as excitement and content, in my opinion.
Yeah, Eve. I knew exactly what it was going to be. When I was watching it, I said, this is the Eve Award show.
And why is that?
Because this is the only award show that honors the best in fantasy, sci-fi, comics, and horror. And these are all the Eve genres. So I knew
Yes. And what's really cool is that tons of people in the audience are dressed up in costumes. They have, like, vampire and werewolf and all kinds of crazy Rocky Horror-looking costumes on. And the celebrities that show up are all, you know, they look very rock and rolled out. And it's very laid back, and it's fun, and there's pyrotechnics, and I just love it. Love it lots.
I knew it.
Although, I don't know how Halle Berry got to... I don't know. It seemed a little confusing. She introduced the awards show, and she was in this fancy gold little mini dress, and I was like, what is she doing? Like, it just seemed a little out of place, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. But you were probably happy. I'm sure you love her, right?
No.
No?
I was surprised that she was even there. This didn't seem like the type of award show that she would show up to.
Well, you know, she's got the X-Men franchise behind her, so I guess if you look at it that way, you could see why she was there.
No.
But she didn't look the part. Like, the other celebrities that showed up, they kind of looked the part. Like, yep, I'm here for my comic book movie or something like that. But she did not seem to fit the mold for that.
What you just said, I could see as being relevant if this was 2000 or 2002 when the X-Men franchise was in full force. But now it makes no sense for her to be there. And there was no host for this, which a lot of times, I don't know why award shows have hosts, because just bring out the presenters and bring out the winners.
Pretty much.
That's what this was.
That's how they did it. Yeah, that's how they did
this. And to give you guys another example of how this was tailor-made for the Eves of Dooms out there, this is the only award show you're going to see Kristen Stewart get up there and win awards for Twilight. And you're going to see all the True Blood people there and having fun and biting each other's necks and tripping on stage. This is the only award show.
Oh, yeah, that was fun. They all were, like, they had a scene, I don't know, they had a lot of special effects going on. Like, they had pyrotechnic, they had it snowing on the stage for a while. And so after it snowed, obviously, it's water, you know, it was like, and the stage was so slippery that everyone that went up there almost slipped and killed themselves. So,
I mean, we don't know. It could have been snow. I mean, soap for all we know, because sometimes they use soap for
fake
snow.
But whatever it was wet. And they all were walking up there, like, really cautiously and, like, having a problem. And a few of the celebrities said, like, oh, it's really slippery up here. So.
And they won an award for the holy S-H-I-T moment. And this is the only award show you're going to see awards like that given out where the guy is...
They say the word.
Well, yeah, that too. But I was talking about the True Blood actual scene where he's... he twists a girl's head around and then humps her. What's going on?
Well, it was a sex scene. And I think in the sex scene, that's what he does. He, like, twists her head around Exorcist style.
Yeah, that's what I meant by humping, Eve. I know you're not up on this new technology.
No, you said that he did that first and then he humped.
No.
I'm trying to say that I think he was already humping and then he did that. That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, I thought that gave away a lot. I haven't seen that episode of True Blood and then he gave it right away.
Well, I'm sure if you're a fan, you've already seen that episode.
Well, I think they gave a lot away. Like spoilers for Zombieland coming up. I don't want to be like the Scream Awards and tell you right away, but they spoiled the Bill Murray cameo in Zombieland, right, which I thought was one of the best parts of Zombieland, is that he appears out of nowhere. And then, he won for best cameo, and then they showed the scene. When Zombieland was up for some award, and then they showed his scene. Out of the entire movie, they could have chose any scene. They picked the one with him in it, his one scene in the movie.
Well, no, didn't they do that because there was a reason? Because he won.
Well, he was there.
He won for best cameo.
No, but that's not movie. What he was like. They did it where they give you multiple awards when you go up there. Like James Cameron won like three awards.
Yeah, and like Christopher Nolan won six. I think.
Yeah, and it was like they went up for one award and then they just handed him the other ones, and that was the best cameo. They said it while he was walking up there for something else, but he came out in his Ghostbusters garb, which that was all over the internet, and those pictures were all over the place before.
Well, yeah, that's what annoyed me, is that the award show aired on Spike TV on a Tuesday, but it had been filmed the previous Saturday. So people that were there, or journalists that were there covering it or what have you, they were posting about the show and they were saying who won. They were showing pictures of the event. So that picture of Bill Murray in the Ghostbusters costume was all over the internet. And then also on Twitter, you probably noticed this, Justin, on Twitter, people were tweeting all about it, like who was winning and pictures and things like that. So I found that to be really annoying because, you know, then you have to wait a couple of days to see it yourself. Meanwhile, all the stuff is out there as quote unquote news. So I don't know why they did that.
Well, I don't like it when they do pre-recorded award shows. I like when they do them live. But this one, you could tell it was pre-recorded because it was highly edited. And every time they wanted a certain reaction shot, I noticed they would go to the crowds and then they wouldn't line up in continuity with each other. So that's why I don't like award shows that aren't live. But the things that I like about the Spike Awards is that, or the Scream Awards, is the same thing that we talked about earlier. you won't see these type of things on other award shows, and right. particularly comic books. This is the only award show that I can think of that gives any type of recognition to comic books. So they actually had two different comic categories. There was best writer and then best comic. So right. that I really like. And each one of the awards were announced on comic books. So when they opened it and said the winner is, and it was a they opened a comic book.
Oh, right.
And that's
yeah,
what they
it
showed.
Wasn't an envelope. It was a comic book that mm-hmm. they opened.
So that I did like. And then they had a little tribute to Ray Bradbury for a Comic-Con icon. So I liked right. all of those things. But Eve, they had a little moment with Wes Craven and some of the original Scream stars, and then one of the new Scream stars, Emma Roberts, I think it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they talked about Scream was a dynasty. Now, what do you think about the Scream dynasty, Eve? I've never heard your thoughts on this.
Well, I'm not sure that it's a dynasty just yet, or what. I guess it was wildly popular at some point. I love the movies. I'm a big fan of Wes Craven, you know, thanks to Nightmare on Elm Street. So I typically will give whatever he does a chance, and I think that the Scream movies are great. I thought they were a really, I mean, like, first of all, they scared me, you know, and a lot of times movies like that, you know, I'm so used to these kinds of horror movies that they don't scare me, but I have to say, it scared me. That first Scream movie scared me, so I like it, and I'm kind of, like, at first, I was indifferent to a fourth Scream movie. I'm like, yeah, all right, whatever, and then I saw they played the trailer. They played, I guess they debuted it at this, at the Scream Awards, and I was like, okay, all right, you got me. I want to see it.
Yeah, they
what
debuted a lot of exclusive stuff at the Spike Awards.
They did.
I was
and
a big
I was going to say, you know, that's another issue with the exclusive footage. If you notice, there was a lot of leaked footage before the airing. Like, so that Scream footage was already online in, like, a really bad bootleg, grainy, like, as if someone there videotaped the screen. So that's another issue, is that they had, I don't know, it seemed like they had at least 10 exclusive footage premieres, right? And 5 of them were on the internet ahead of time because of that. So I think that's another issue with having it pre-recorded like that.
Mm-hmm. So, when I think of Scream and the sequels, my memories are all of Scary Movie. That's what I think of when I think of...
You know what? You're right. It's like, well, we talked about this on another podcast about how there are certain movies that we liked, but because they did these really good parodies of them, remember we were talking about, actually we were talking about Signs and The Village and how when I was watching The Village, not The Village, when I was watching Signs, I kept expecting Cameron Manheim to show up because of the Scream movie. So yeah, I have that same, I do have that same problem a little bit with those movies because they were so successfully parodied. There was one interesting award that you don't normally see at these award shows, and it was for, I think it was anticipated movie. They didn't specify, like, how far in advance, but they said most anticipated movie. And so, Justin, were you surprised at the winner of this award?
Out of the ones that won, I'm trying to remember. I remember Tron was one of them.
It was Harry Potter and Deathly Hallows, Breaking Dawn, you know, Twilight movie. Tron Legacy, Green Lantern, and mysteriously enough, Cowboys and Aliens, which I can't imagine is on anyone's radar besides mine and yours. So.
Yeah, the other ones are kind of close, and Green Lantern is not till next year. So I didn't, but Cowboys and Aliens is kind of far off. So yeah, I don't know what the...
I think that was like, they were like, oh, I have no idea here. Throw in this movie, it's Jon Favreau.
Yeah, but I also didn't know how they chose the... Did they let the fans vote on these awards?
I think the fans voted. Yeah. So, which is why I find... I don't know about you, but I find it a little strange that Green Lantern actually won.
I thought it was cool that Ryan Reynolds came out in the Green Lantern power battery.
Oh, I do too. I thought it was really cool.
And Geoff Johns was there. He won for Best Comic... writer earlier in the show, and he's a big Green Lantern writer right now at DC, and he's a part of the movie. So that was fun to have him there as well. But that was cool, seeing that giant lantern. And they did a bunch of stuff like that. They had the DeLorean come out. They had the alien thing that...
Right, the alien egg.
Yeah, Sigourney Weaver popped out of. So they had a lot of cool kind of...
Well, they had that entrances. Whole thing in the beginning with Inception.
Oh, yeah.
They actually had like an orchestra set up to play the music, and they made the backdrop look like the buildings from Inception.
Yeah, that was really cool.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing I was saying about the comic books, I like that they recognize the comic creators, and I kind of, it opened my eyes when I heard them say the creators' names. I was like, oh, wait, I didn't realize they were going to be talking about Robert Kirkman, Jeff Johns, and all these different people. But I felt like the audience had no clue who these people were, and I felt like it was canned applause, and it wasn't. Like, nobody was screaming for, like, when they got up there, when Robert Kirkman and Jeff Johns won their awards, and they got up and they were thanking other parts of their creative team, like, they were thanking the artists, the inkers, the colors. Right. Everybody, like, it almost felt like they're like, wait, oh, who? Like, so that to me felt weird. Like, I felt like people didn't know what was going on.
Well, you know, if they keep doing it, people will learn. You know, especially since all of these comic book creators are now involved in TV and film, you know, adaptations of their work. So they're going to get the attention and people will know who they are. But yeah, they like no one's ever going to clap for the inker, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But oh, so before you were saying about the types of awards that go out, like there are, say, best comic book writer, best TV show, best movie, right? But they also had, like you said, the holy shit scene of the year. But they also had awards for best worst movie and most memorable mutilation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you don't see that everywhere. And what, you know, what they did do that was different from other award shows is, like, let's say there are five things up for an award. So, you know, five best memorable mutilations, right? Okay. So what they would do is that they would say four of them, and then they'd say, and the winner is, and the winner was the fifth choice. So they didn't give you all five and then announce who the winner was. They were like, here's four, and then the fifth one is, and then they would do, like, a lot of times they would do, like, something that ties in to that win. So they did that with the Zombieland win, when Zombieland won, and then Bill Murray came out in the Ghostbusters suit, and then they said, Bill Murray won for best cameo. Like, I don't know, did they have, was it like, we got a truncated version of the show? Was the show really, like, 4 hours, and we only got 2 hours of it?
Because I think it was.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to say, they kept going like, oh, and by the way, they also won all these other awards. And you're like, really? When?
Oh, I don't know if they presented them. But I could tell that there was corners cut. Because there was even times where, like, I guess when they're walking to the stage, they cut that time out. So I think it went, a lot longer than what we saw.
Right, right.
But I don't know if they actually presented those other awards, though.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, they did seem to have a lot of things planned around award wins and such like that. So I guess if it was just like, okay, yeah, you won this award, come up, thanks, goodbye. They, you know, if they didn't have like a grand moment to go with it, then they didn't air it on TV. But I think I would have liked to see the whole thing actually look like fun. But I did, right after I watched the award show, I wrote up an article at Geeks of Doom called Five Awesome Moments from Spike TV's Scream 2010 Awards, and I embedded some video in that post, so you go check that out, where I give you my top five favorite things from the award show. So this week we had Paranormal Activity 2 was the new movie, and so was the Clint Eastwood-directed Matt Damon starring Hereafter. So, Justin, who was the big winner this week?
Paranormal Activity 2, which was not surprising to me because of the buzz around this movie and because of the success of the first movie, being one of the most successful, financially successful movies of all time. The first movie on a $15,000 budget made almost $200 million. So I figured the anticipation for the second movie was going to be great, and it was. It made $41.5 million on 3,000 screens, so that is pretty good. And it's also another release from Paramount, which Paramount had the number one movie last week with Johnny Knoxville and company making, you know, $50 million, setting a record last week. So this week, Paranormal Activity set another record, and it was like one of the highest grossing horror movies, horror debuts of all time. And so that movie, both of those are Paramount movies, so it was a big win for Paramount because, again, the Johnny Knoxville's movie came in second this week with $21 million, bringing its total to $87 million. Eve, at 2 weeks, they've made about $90 million.
Wow.
So anyone thinking that there's not going to be a fourth installment to that series, I think you need to look at the box office here because that is definitely going to happen. The movie we talked about, was it last week or 2 weeks ago? Red?
It was last week.
Okay, that came in third, pulling in $15 million and bringing its total to $43 million. The Clint Eastwood movie Hereafter, which had a limited release earlier, now opened up into a wide release of 2,000 theaters. That came in at a disappointing fourth with $12 million. And Social Network rounded out the top five, making $7 million, bringing its total to $72 million. So as good a movie as Social Network is, I think Social Network is one of the best movies of the year. It's still being outpaced by human waste products being thrown at each other and other things. So that's what people want to see these days, Eve.
Apparently, yeah. There goes movies like Let Me In. No one wants to see them. Paranormal Activity 2. Justin, did it scare you?
As a matter of fact, I want to tell everybody, don't see Paranormal Activity late at night and then come home to an empty house. Because it won't be the easiest thing to get to sleep. I learned that the hard way after I saw Paranormal Activity 2 at 10 o'clock.
Oh, I see.
And last night I had to sleep with my door closed.
I was going to say, but that shower curtain you have doesn't scare you.
No, that, right? No. That's all fun and games, Eve.
No, that's not fun and games. I will not be visiting you.
No.
As long as you have that shower curtain.
That is the best shower curtain. And it is reminiscent of Psycho, which is one of my top five favorite movies of all time.
Mm, yeah, so but I like it too, but I don't want to live it. You know what I mean?
No. That's... Yeah, like I said, that's fun and games. Paranormal Activity is scary, Eve.
Well, you know, speaking of watching things late at night and coming home to an empty house, I had to do that when the Cape Fear remake came out, Robert De Niro. I was so scared, and then I went home, and the house was empty, and it was late at night, and all by myself. I was very frightened. So, but yeah, I would not go out like you did. Late at night, watch Paranormal Activity 2, and then sit home by myself in the dark. No.
Mm-hmm.
Bad move, Justin. Bad move.
So that is my advice to all of you out there. Paranormal Activity 2, even though it's labeled as a sequel, it's actually a prequel. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, Eve, can you think of any other movie franchise that has done that? Labeled something number 2, but actually been a prequel?
Well, that's true. I didn't even realize that. I don't know.
I think this is the first time. And I think that's actually mismarketing.
Oh, it's definitely mismarketing because how many people knew it was a prequel? Probably nobody.
Yeah.
Do you think the people lined up knew it was a prequel? I don't think they cared, truthfully.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even think people... First of all, you know what I thought up until about, I don't know, maybe... be a week before the movie came out, I thought it was completely separate.
That's
new
what
tapes
I thought.
From a new family, mm-hmm. from an unrelated family.
Well, I even
found, and here it is.
I even told people, I said, you know what? They probably don't connect, so you probably don't have to see.
Right. Meanwhile,
the first one.
Nope.
I mean, you could, since this is a prequel, you could see this one first and then go see the second one. Although this one does kind of give away some information.
Well, I was going to say there's a reveal in like towards the end of the film. There was a reveal that I actually didn't see coming. And I was like, oh, you know, because I had seen the first movie and I was like, oh, man. I was like, now it all makes sense, you know. So, yeah. So, you know, I really didn't think I was going to like this movie. If you listened to last week's episode, at the end I said, I don't think I want to go see Paranormal Activity 2. You know, we'll probably talk about something else. And then as the release date drew nearer, and I don't know, I had to write a news story about it. So I had to do a little bit of research, and I realized it was a prequel, and that it involved the people from the first movie, and it was the same family, but instead of that, the girl Katie, it was her sister. And something about it, I was like, you know, I think I want to see it now, because they tied it together and I thought it'd be interesting. And so I'm actually glad I went, because I did like it. I wouldn't say I was scared. I don't know. I think in a movie like this, now that you've seen the first movie, right, you know what to expect. So I don't think there was any surprises as far as being frightened. There weren't any surprises. And you spend a lot of time staring at the screen, waiting to catch something. You're like, okay, is this when it's going to happen? Is this when, you know, some invisible demon activity is going to happen? And so there was a lot of scenes where nothing happened. Did you notice that? Mm-hmm. There was a lot of scenes where it was like standard security video of absolutely nothing happening.
Yeah, and that's just like the first movie, though, so it's not unexpected. If you've seen the first movie, there's a lot of scenes in that one where I thought nothing was happening. So I think it was just more of the same in the second movie.
No, but the difference is that in the first movie, it was a person with a a handheld camera going around. And so any time nothing really happened, I felt like, well, you know, you're seeing it through that person's eyes, and that person is looking to see if something's happening. So if nothing happens, then you're like, okay, nothing happened, but that person behind the camera was looking. In this case, there was a handheld camera, but there was also security cameras that were set up around the house, and there was a lot of times where, you know, whoever the editor of this movie, who is fictional, I guess you could say, right? The fictional editor of this movie, whoever they were, when they put the clips together, they picked, you know, you would say like, well, they picked clips that absolutely nothing is happening. So that was kind of weird, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this movie was definitely, it wasn't as scary during the movie, but for me, the scary part was going home and thinking about it, and
yeah.
So I think it's much more of a psychological thriller where you have to think. I guess, or I should say, psychological horror. I'm sorry, where the horror isn't necessarily on the screen, although there are some disturbing sequences in the movie. It's not necessarily a slasher film or a gory torture porn movie where you know, you're seeing people's heads cut off left and right and arms and legs flying around. But this one, it's definitely the thinking part about it, where you think about the terror that happens, and also thinking about if this happened to you.
Right, you're thinking like, okay, well, this could never happen. But then you start to think like, what if that, you know, look, it happened to them out of nowhere. They didn't see it coming, right? Those people weren't like, hey, one day I'm gonna have a demon terrorizing me, right? And so you think like, oh man, what if that's me one day? And you know, I live in a condo complex where I'm on the ground floor, so there are people above me, and for some bizarre reason every morning it sounds like my neighbors upstairs are rolling a bowling ball from one end of the house to the other, and I hear these strange sounds all day long. And, you know, obviously I assume it's my neighbors upstairs, right? So after seeing this movie, I'm just thinking like, the demon is bowling again, you know? Mm-hmm. Now I'm done thinking that. So, yeah. Actually, we should probably tell people a little bit about what the movie is about. Right? So the first movie, there was this couple, Katie and Micah. Was the guy's name Micah?
Mm-hmm.
Micah. The weird things start happening in the house. And so Katie then tells her boyfriend, like, well, you know, when I was little, weird things like this used to happen too. And it feels the same way. So the boyfriend goes and gets a camera, and he's like, well, we'll set up a camera for while we're asleep, and we'll see if things happen while we're sleeping. And at first, nothing happens, but then things start to happen. Doors slam, and, you know, they got they found footprints and things like that. Lights flickered on and off and things like that. So in the second movie, it's a prequel story with Katie's sister and her family. So it's Katie's sister, the sister's husband, they have a baby, and they have like the husband has a daughter, and then they have like a German Shepherd dog, and they live in the house. I think it's supposed to be around the corner or something like that, and weird things start to happen, and Katie actually shows up in this movie, and so does her boyfriend. And Katie, oh, they're talking, remember when we were little and weird things used to happen? So they bring that up. And so it's a whole thing. But this one I felt like is definitely more intricate. With the first movie, it was just, you know, the boyfriend with the camera. So it was very shaky. It wasn't as easy to watch. Where in this movie, when things start going wrong, they install these security cameras all over the house. And the cameras... which I wanna know where you get cameras like this that record 24/7. By the way, do you know? Do these cameras exist? Like, how rich do you have to be to get them?
Yeah, I don't know if they're consumer level. I know there are cameras like that. I don't know if they're consumer level like that. But I thought that was a great device. Just mm-hmm. the way that everything was set up and the way that the world was built and the backstory. That's what I thought. What was great about this movie is that it built upon the first one and it developed that whole backstory in the family, because it sounds like it would be very cheesy or corny, like, oh, she just discovered she just happened to have a sister, and the exact same thing is happening to the sister that happened in the first one. Like, if you just told me that, I would, like, oh, that's dumb. I don't want to see that. But they really do a good job and make everything in it believable and not, like, cheesy or corny. Like, I totally bought everything that they explained and the way that they said that everything happened. So I think that if we're going to look at one versus two, I think I like two more because of that, because it takes all of that and builds upon it. And at the same time, it amps up everything that was in the first one. I think the second one was scarier than the first one. But then also, I saw the second one in the theater versus... Mm-hmm. Now, you did the same thing that I did. We both saw the first movie at home.
Right.
In the comfort of our own homes. There's definitely a different experience when you're seeing something at home by yourself versus when you're seeing it with an audience of people who are into it and who, you know, who want to be scared and who love horror movies. Having girls react screaming in the audience and everyone having a good time is a totally different experience. And I think I've talked about on this podcast before, I'm not sure, but when you're in a theater, there are no distractions. It's totally dark in the theater. You know, I mean, you can get up and go to the bathroom or go get something to eat or something, but it's different where I am very easily distracted in my home. Yeah, a lot of times I'll pause a movie because somebody's talking to me on Twitter. I'll, you know, get up and get a drink, or I'm doing all
like
of
on
these.
The phone.
Yeah, somebody calls me on the phone. All of these different distractions are email. Mm-hmm. And sometimes an hour and a half movie, it'll take me 4 hours to watch it. And I'm like, man, I wish I could just, you know, not be distracted and just go right through a movie. And when you're in the theater, it's a lot easier to just, okay, no distractions. You're totally focused in on the movie. And that right there changes your experience when you're totally focused in on a movie versus if you're watching a movie on DVD or Blu-ray, you could be, again, you could, even if I didn't pause the movie, if I'm watching the movie and I'm checking my email, checking Twitter, I'm not giving the movie my full attention.
Right, right.
And for these type of movies, these type of scary movies, which, like I said, there isn't a lot of gory stuff and a lot of blood and that type of scares. The scares really require you to invest your attention in the movie. Right. So that, I think, also played into my experience where I thought the second one was scarier. And really, those parts that you talked about that you didn't, where nothing happened, those weren't the scary parts, but they just built your anticipation for the right. scare. And every time you were like, okay, the tension is building, and then, okay, relief. Building, uh-huh. relief. And then
it was all about tension.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it happened so many times that by the final act of the movie, when everything, like, there is no relief. It's just up. And that was the part that I thought was scary. And I thought that was really well done, the way that they used the music, the way that they used the sound effects, all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Just that final act, I don't know how long it was, but I was just, you know, gripping the edge of my seat the whole time. I was like, oh no, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen next? And then, you know, finally and there was even kind of that at the end. I don't know if you noticed this, but there was an end. There was like the credit, like the movie was over.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And then people were still in their chairs waiting. Oh wait, is something else going to happen? Because there's just a black screen.
Wait. Here's what I thought when I saw that, right? Because you're right. At the end of the movie, it's just a black screen. And, you know, you wait like 5 seconds and you figure something else is going to happen, right? Mm-hmm. And nothing does. And it continues. Just a black screen and it's silent. And everyone, like at my theater, everyone stayed in their seat. And then after a while, you heard people going like, what's going on? Like whispering, just like, what's going on? Whatever. And can I tell you? I think that was the scariest part of the movie.
Yeah. And that's
because
always...
I started freaking out. I actually started freaking out. Like, I started looking around me going like, oh my God, this is when it gets 4D, right? Is it 4D now? Like, they're going to have someone come out and jump at me or something like that. I was really freaked out. And then when the credits came, I started laughing. Like, that same thing, that release of tension where people were like, oh, mm-hmm. No. So, and when I was leaving the theater, there were two, you know, how they come and clean up afterwards. So two of the workers were standing at the door waiting for us to leave. And I was like one of the first people out. And I heard one of them say to the other one, why are they all just sitting there like that? And the guy was like, oh, yeah, they that's how they end the movie. Like, it's just like minutes of, you know, a couple minutes of silence and people don't know if the movie's over or not. So, yeah.
Yeah, and that plays into what I think makes a good horror movie is they can't top what's in your mind, what you can think of or dream of most of the time. It's always going to be scarier than what they think of. So when they make you the filmmaker and they make your imagination the creative force behind the movie, that's when I think it's the scariest, when they don't show you everything, mm-hmm. when they let your mind make up what, you know, the entity looks like or the killer looks like. That is what I find most scary. So that's what I felt like this movie did. And I wasn't that scared by the first one, but I think maybe if I had seen it in the theater, I can see why it was so successful and why so many people loved the first movie, because it was probably the experience that I got out of this one in the theater.
Right. So, I agree.
Yeah, that's why I thought that this one was scarier. But like I said, I think it may have had to do with just my experience overall.
Yeah, because I think the first movie, especially since... it was shrouded in secrecy, that first movie. You know, they like to make it like it's a documentary horror, like based on, you know, like this is found footage of real events, you know, and the actors in the movie are unknown. You have no idea who they are. So it's not like you go, hey, yeah, it's that girl from the Campbell's commercial. Like, you've never seen them before. And I think the first one, because you don't know what's going on, you don't know why, you don't know when the demon's going to strike or anything like that, I think it probably was a scary movie. I'm guessing it's scarier, I should say. I'm guessing in the theater, it probably was a scarier movie than the second one, because the second one now, you already know this demon, you know, and you already know sort of what's going to happen. And also, I felt like there was a lot of scenes that were, was like not so dark, I should say. Like, in the first movie, it's mostly at night, they're videoing. The whole time, they're under duress. Whereas in this movie, it starts out, they're happy, they just had a baby, they're swimming in the swimming pool. You know, there's outdoor scenes, there's scenes of the house in daylight, you know, of the daughter painting her nails and stuff. So there's a lot of things that are very light. And then, you know, there's tension and there's scary stuff. Where the first movie, I felt like it was, the first movie really, really feels like a low budget indie horror, you know, like that just gets you out of nowhere. Whereas this one, it just felt a little bit bigger and not as frightening. And I should also mention that there are two aspects or two incidents in the film that I felt were the things that would have kept me from seeing it. And I've read online that a lot of people had an issue with, and it's the fact that the demon attacks the dog and the demon also attacks the baby. So
actually, one of my friends on Twitter said, does the dog survive? And your answer will dictate whether I see the movie or not. Was yeah. The concern was the dog. So there are a lot of people that I've seen like that. But
well, I saw the trailer, and in the trailer you see like the baby being dragged,
mm-hmm.
like not horrifically dragged, like they're in the crib and they're being like, you could see something is moving them. And I kind of was like, oh man, I don't want to go see this if they're like, you know, baby in a crib being terrorized by a demon. Like, I kind of was like, I don't want to see that.
Well, but that then, was that same thing that they always do in the trailers. You think yeah. there's going to be more, and that's really all
that's
there
really
was.
That's really it, right.
Yeah.
Well, there was actually another scene, which I kind of thought was almost funny. Like, yeah. when the baby is floating.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it actually came across pretty funny, because the baby isn't harmed. It doesn't seem like the demon, I don't think, is out to harm the baby.
Yeah.
Right? Mm. It's like, that's not the goal. The baby's not, it doesn't seem like the baby's in danger.
Well, yeah, but it wants to take the baby. It's kind of like Ghostbusters right. 2.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It wants to take the baby.
Right.
Our friend from the / Filmcast, Devendra, he was saying on Twitter 3 hours ago, I guess he just saw the movie, Paranormal Activity 2 was fantastic, performs a narrative miracle. Dave Chinsky is woefully misguided once again. And I have to agree with Devendra, because I saw Dave's post on / Film about the movie, and he wasn't too hot about it. And I feel like I'm much more on Devendra's side. Like I said, the story and the world that they build in this is something that I never expected that them to do, to retroactively go back and tell this backstory and make it so, like I said, just make it interesting, engaging, and something that I didn't think about before I saw this. And I also was thinking about the Blair Witch Project when I watched this movie, because if you remember, the Blair Witch was an indie hit like the first right. Paranormal Activity. Then they got a big budget studio sequel, and I thought,
flopped, yeah.
Yeah, everything about what made the first one great, they kind of lost it in the second one, because they right. just, it felt like they just threw money at it, and then the second one, they lost all of the heart of the movie. So right. when I was watching this one, I said, yeah, this will be interesting to see. This one has a much bigger budget. Is this going to be, are they going to be able to capture the same magic that the first Paranormal Activity did only a year ago? And right. that's nothing you got to forget. The first one came out last year. So
right, yeah.
That's another thing that I was thinking about.
Well, we should bring up that the fact that Justin really liked this movie and actually likes it better than the first movie is a big deal, because Justin is not a fan of prequels, right? So the fact that you are enjoying this prequel better than the first movie is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, and that's what I think they were able to like I said, I keep going back to what I said earlier. Like, I just never thought that they would be able to retroactively go back and tell that story and make it interesting. But I think that's what the goal of a prequel should be,
yeah.
is to go back and fill in that backstory in an entertaining way and a creative way. And I feel like most sequels we've seen, they've never lived up to the original, and they never made me care about the backstory, because a lot of times, and of course, the most popular prequel that we can always judge is the Star Wars prequels. As much fun as it is to spend time, because, you know, we love Jedis and we love
right.
Star Wars, there's just the universe. As much fun as it is, I don't know if that added anything to the actual overall storyline of Star Wars that we wanted to know. Like, did we really want to know the backstory? Because I feel like before the prequels came out, we were like, yeah, we want to know. And then after we've seen the Star Wars prequels, we were like, no, we were better off not knowing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of like that horror movie thing that I just talked about. It's better in our imagination than it is for them to just spell it out and tell us exactly how this happened or
right.
how they got to that point.
Well, especially with Star Wars, after all those years, you know, people coming up with their own backstories for their character and for the universe, so then to be told it. So actually, it was probably a good idea that Paramount rushed out to give you this prequel so, like, you know, in so little time, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, because... You know, you're not sitting there, you know, forming your own opinions of, like, what ifs for this family. You didn't even know that there was going to be a whole family involved. She does mention the sister in the first movie, but I don't know about you, but I didn't have any idea that they were going to bring the sister into this.
Yeah, I had no idea. I didn't know anything about this going into it. I just knew, I thought it was the sequel to the first one. I didn't know anything else about this movie.
Right.
Which... I thought was a good way to go into it.
So, Justin and I both give Paranormal Activity 2 the thumbs up and suggest that if you want to see this movie, definitely head out to the theater to go see it. Just don't come home alone at night after seeing it.
This is correct.
So, speaking of going to the theater, Justin and I actually... went to the theater this weekend to see a very, very, very special showing of Back to the Future. So it turns out that all across the country, there were these special showings of Back to the Future on Saturday, and also this coming Monday, October 25th. That is the day that the movie begins. It's not the day that Marty goes back in time, but it is the day that the film begins. So that's pretty cute that they're releasing it now that it's the 25th anniversary of the release of the first film. So I went, Justin went, we got free posters they gave out at my theater. They had these little flyers that said Save the Clock Tower. It was really cute. And I thought it was really wonderful to see it again in the theater. I saw it when it first came out, and so I was really excited to see it back in the movie theater, even though I own it. Justin owns it. We've seen it a million times. It's, you know, it's Justin's favorite movie of all time. It's definitely one of my top movies of all favorite movies of all time. So it was really cool to see it in a theater where all the people there sort of have the same reactions as you. They cheer when you cheer and they clap when you clap. And it was really like just a very triumphant screening, I felt like. How was it at your screening, Justin?
Yeah, it was the same for me, but I found it more interesting than anything else because my entire life I've watched it by myself. So I know when I laugh and I know what parts I find funny. Watching it in a packed theater, like there was no empty seats in my theater.
Yeah,
and
me too.
Hearing everyone's reaction to parts of the movie, that's what I found more interesting, actually, was a lot of times I stopped watching the movie and I started just listening to the crowd's reaction to certain mm-hmm. scenes, and I found that to be the most interesting part of this whole experience. And it was just like kind of like what we were saying with Paranormal Activity. It's a different experience when you're seeing a movie by yourself in your house and in a theater with people who want to be there. That's why I've always been a fan of seeing movies at midnight, because that's when you get the really diehard people who want to be there. And I think Spider-Man 2 might have been my first time really coming to that realization, like people getting all of the jokes, like knowing the character and loving the character, and things that a normal audience member might go over their head, like an in joke or an inside joke, that this audience would get. So they're much more receptive. They laugh when, you know, when a joke happens, they laugh. When a dramatic moment happens or a scary moment happens, they jump. So that's my favorite experience, is seeing it with a crowd of people who really want to be there. And with this movie, you knew everyone wanted to be there. Everyone has love for this film. And I think the majority of the people had seen the movie before, although there were some little kids in the movie that...
Yeah, there were some little kids there too.
Yeah, this might have been their first experience with Back to the Future. But I really found it fascinating, like I said, to see people, what parts they laughed at, and some people laughing before the joke because they already knew what was going to happen and they started laughing.
Right.
So a lot of the Christopher Lloyd's reactions and his facial expressions, that just killed the audience that I was in. Like everybody.
Yeah, I noticed that too. Like when there was the scene where Marty's mom comes to see him when they cover up the DeLorean, and he's like behind her and he's like making these bug eye faces and everything, and everyone was just cracking up in my theater.
Yeah. So that was definitely a rewarding experience. I would actually go again tomorrow, the 25th. They're playing it again, but I have another screening at that time. So if I didn't have another screening, I would go to it again because I had such a good time the first time.
Yeah, I came away feeling the same way as you did, so much so that when I came home from the screening, it inspired me to write something, which will be posted Monday morning. It's called Revisiting a Classic, 13 Moments from Back to the Future That Still Get a Reaction. So, because I was so impressed with the fact that it was just like the whole audience just cheered and clapped at all the same things. And it's all the same things that, like, how I've been feeling every time I watch it. And so I was so inspired by the experience that, you know, I felt like I should write, you know, I mean, there were definitely more than 13. I can tell you that much. But it was like, I guess you could say, like, the most, you know, the most got the most reactions out of it. So I was definitely inspired by that. I mean, you had, as soon as Michael J. Fox appears, people clapped and cheered. You know, same thing when Christopher Lloyd appeared, and when the DeLorean appeared. So, you know, you had all that. I mean, they were clapping at the title treatment. They were, you know, I mean, like, they were clapping and haranguing at so many different points. But so, you know, just because you love it so much. But then there were parts that, you know, got like really big laughs, like when Marty's brother is getting ready to go to work and he kisses his parents goodbye and he kisses his father on the head and he goes, oh, whoa, time to change that oil. Like, everyone was hysterical at that point. And so I thought that was like, you know, I mean, it's like it obviously was meant to be a joke. Like, they wrote it as a joke, like, oh, it'll get a laugh. But this was like a big laugh, like as if you've never seen this before. That's how big the laugh was.
Yeah. And I had a few annoying people in my theater. There's one girl who had an annoying laugh, and every time she laughed at the weirdest things, like when no one else was laughing, she was, I can't give you any examples, but it was just the strangest thing.
Probably
she was
like
laughing at
nervous laughter or something like that.
Yeah. And then,
I don't think I had anyone like that at my theater.
And I always hate when I have the guy right behind me who has to say everything he's thinking. There's no filter in, oh, maybe,
you know,
I should just think this.
I think every time you go to the movie, that guy sits behind you.
Yeah.
Because this happens to you all the time.
And then they have to read, like, if they see a word on the screen, they have to read it out loud, like no one else can read. Or if there's a subtitle, they have to read it out loud.
Save the clock tower, right? And they see the flyer.
Yeah. I hate it when they have to repeat what they just heard that they thought was funny. Like, great, Scott. Like, yes, I heard him say it, and he delivered it a lot better than you. Can I just listen to the actor, please? So I hate it when those guys happen to come out to my theater. That was another one. Actually, a lot of people were yelling out, great, Scott.
Right.
Our theater cheered when George punched Biff at the end.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There was thunderous applause during that scene, for sure.
Yeah. But Back to the Future, as you said, is my favorite movie of all time. So I'm really happy that I got a chance to see this in the theater, because there have been a lot of times that I've watched it and said, man, what was it like in 1985 to see this in the theater? So right. I know now it's a different experience now because we have different type of movie theaters. You know, the sound is better. The picture is better now. So there are things that I'm sure the experience in certain ways was degraded back then. But in another sense, I would like to be in 1985 when this was, it's still relevant now today, but yeah. When it was a current movie in 1985, when the fashions in the 80s were current, when the music was current, all of these things, I would have liked to have been there just to experience it as a something in pop culture. Because Back to the Future now is one of the biggest science fiction things in pop culture, period. So
right.
There's always references to, I mean, anytime you see a DeLorean, you automatically think Back to the Future. And a lot of times when people hear Huey Lewis, the first thing they think is Back to the Future, even though
that was one of the things I wrote in my article, is that, yeah, Huey Lewis had some hits back in the 80s, right? Mm-hmm. But he definitely is not one for longevity in the music career, you know? Mm-hmm. And I feel like people have affection for him now because he did those songs, you know what I mean? So it's like, even someone like me, and Justin, you know me pretty well, right? Like, I was not listening to Huey Lewis back in the 80s, you know? But I tell you, when I hear those Back to the Future songs, I love them so much.
I know you don't like pop songs. And
I don't.
Those were, like, at that time, I'm sure, the biggest hits on the pop charts.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Which, of course, drove me crazy mm-hmm. back then. But, I in the context of the movie, I was okay with it. Mm-hmm. You know, I just wasn't like, yeah, I love Huey Lewis now. I'm going to, like, get a Huey Lewis t-shirt and all that.
And his cameo in the movie brought out a lot of laughter in the crowd as well.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
But I was, like I said, I haven't had this experience before, because the only thing that's come close, well, actually, was that Exorcist experience. That's the only time I've ever watched a movie re-released into the theater. Well, no, I take that back.
Wait, you went to see The Exorcist in the theater, or re-release?
Yeah, in 2000, I'm sorry, we were talking off the air. There was the re-release for The Exorcist, and it was billed as the scariest movie of all time. So at the time, I wanted to see it, and it didn't live up to my expectations, but we can get into that on another show. So that was really the only experience. But then now that I'm thinking about it, I did see when Lion King was re-released in IMAX. I did see it.
Oh yeah, I went to that too.
Yeah, yeah, I remember seeing that, and Beauty and the Beast same way in IMAX. Mm-hmm. So I have had some experience, but not like the Star Wars when the special editions were re-released in the theater.
Right.
I didn't get the chance to see those because I was overseas at the time. I was my dad was in the military, so we were in Japan. So this was my first chance that a classic movie that I had loved for so long on DVD, well, first on VHS, then on DVD, and now this week you and I will be getting the Blu-ray. So yay! That's another way that we'll be seeing it, which they did have a little contest when I walked into the theater.
Oh, yeah, they did. They had a contest, too.
Somebody won the Blu-ray in my audience. But the only question that they asked that I didn't know was the one that won the Blu-ray. It was, what was the price of gas in 1955?
Oh, man. But was it a nickel?
No.
What was it?
It was 19 cents.
Oh, okay.
But everything else.
Something with a nickel. I think the cup of coffee was a nickel. Oh, something with a nickel.
Yeah, I don't remember. But that, I'm really, like I said, I'm just glad I got a chance to see it in the theater with a crowd. And it was the print that we're going to see on the Blu-ray. It was the digital remastering.
Right.
So it didn't, I wouldn't say the film looked like it could have come out today, But it definitely doesn't look like a film that was made in 1985.
No. So. It looked really good.
Yeah.
It looked really good.
So that was cool. And seeing it kind of with the theater speakers was also, I enjoyed. I know you're not the biggest surround sound proponent.
Not in my house. I'm not.
Yeah. Oh, and speaking of the people behind me, this lady behind me in the no excrement Sherlock category, as soon as we're done with the movie, she says, "I like that movie." And then gets up and walks out. "Oh, really? Is that why you're at this re-release? Is that why you're here? Because you like the movie? Get out of here."
No one else does. Just you, lady.
So that was interesting. But, you know, the reason this movie is my favorite is because it holds up so well to me trying to pick it apart. Because
that's so funny you say that, because I was thinking about that too. I'm like, you know, a lot of films, they could be my favorite film of all time or what have you, but I can still rip it to shreds, and I feel like I really can't rip this movie to shreds too much. I mean, there are a couple of things, but like, I mean, as far as like things you point and laugh at and, you know, you just rip apart, no. And I definitely think this movie holds up very well over time. Like, you could release this movie today, and I think, you know, like, for the very first time, and I think it would be a hit, because it's just an amazing film. It's like a wonderful piece of filmmaking, and just the little, you know, parts that they put, it just, everything about it is great.
And the reason you could release it today is because that it's timeless, and whether you do it with these two time periods, the 50s and the 80s, or if you moved it to today and did, I don't know, the 70s and this generation now, it would still work, I think, because at its essence and its core, the reason that it's timeless is because the idea is, or, you know, if you said, what's the concept of Back to the Future? What if you could go back in time to when your parents were in high school and you met your parents in high school? And that's a universal theme that goes across time and
cultures.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because I think that concept is always going to exist as long as we have parents, as long as we have schools. Like this, seeing your parents, because this is a topic that I think about all the time. My parents, like, they're so different now. And I was thinking about myself too. I was thinking about when I was in high school. Even till now, I'm a different person than I was in high school. So you think about just that time in your life of high school, and, you know, you have certain views on life and
how everything is so important. Like Marty going up to the lake was like the most important thing in his life at that moment. Like everything is just so dire at that age.
Yeah. But that core concept is what I love. And the first thing that originally drew me to it was the time travel concept. Cause I've always been a time travel fan going back as a kid, because it was something that I wanted to do. It's kind of like why I loved Superman and being able to fly, because that was something I always wanted to do. Time travel was the same way. So that was the first thing. And then I think I also loved Michael J. Fox as a kid. I used to watch Family Ties.
Yeah, me too.
Even though I didn't, you know, it didn't make sense to me. Like, watching Family Ties now, I'm like, all this stuff flew over my head about his parents and Reaganomics and all these different things. Like, all that stuff went over my head. I just liked Michael J. Fox because I thought he was funny and I thought he was cool, and I wanted to be friends with him as a little kid. So, and I remember watching Secret of My Success and all these things.
Oh, right.
He was getting laid in that movie. I didn't know what was going on. All of these things. I'd always followed his career, but yeah, Back to the Future was the one that always stood out to me as why I loved Michael J. Fox. So, again, I think I've seen websites that have been like, okay, here's all the errors in Back to the Future.
Right.
But I still think, for my money, this is the tightest film I can think of, where anytime I try to think about a flaw in the movie or something that, you know, as we watch the movie and we come out of it, we have an initial thought. But then later, when you go back and think about it, like, over the years, I've thought about Back to the Future over and over and over again. And every time, yeah, like, I try to pick it apart, I'm unsuccessful in doing so, which endears me to the movie even more. It makes me love the movie even more. And watching it again, because I don't know, you know, for the thousandth time.
Yeah.
I also think this is the densest movie I can think of. And what I mean by that is it's per minute, the amount of information and
right.
entertainment that happens per minute in this movie. I don't know of any other movie I can think of that is as densely packed as Back to the Future, because I don't think you can delete any scene. I think every moment of the movie is important. I think everything serves the characters and everything serves the story and moves it forward, and it does it in an entertaining and funny way. So I just can't think of any other movie that if you lost a scene, it would really greatly hurt the movie. Like, you know, a lot of movies, I'm always like, they could have cut 10 minutes here. They could have cut 15 minutes here. Back to the Future, for me, and I don't think there is such a thing as a perfect movie. I think Back to the Future is the closest thing to a perfect movie, just from my taste and sensibility.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's also, too, like, they managed to tie everything together in a very organic way. Like, nothing feels forced, like we said with the Star Wars prequels. Like, some of that stuff feels forced. They're like, oh, we got to make it fit. In this film, everything, like every wink, every nod, everything that shows up in the beginning of the film. You know how there's that rule where it's like, if you see a spoon in a movie, like, well, that spoon has to, you know, there has to be a reason for it later. Yeah. This whole movie is like that, where every single thing that you see, even the aerobics, you know, he's like on the skateboard and he rides past the aerobics studio and they're all, you know, the hands are up in the air and he waves at them. So it's like, that's even something like that, that you would think is insignificant, is important, because that building becomes an important part of the movie. So I feel like they managed to tie everything together absolutely perfectly. That's how I felt. And I was thinking that after I saw it in theater, I was like, wow, you know, they just, like, I don't know, everything was so spot on. And I can't really find flaws with it. I think I found one thing where I said, like, oh, why would they do that? But it was, like, so minor. I don't even remember it now. And I used to remember those things, but I don't even remember.
I think another thing about this movie is every element of the movie, everything that makes up a movie, was fantastic. Just if you think about the acting, the directing, the characters, the story, the pacing, like I said, it just moves along at such a great pace. Like, I can't think of another movie that can top Back to the Future's pacing. The music, and that's not only, we talked about the soundtrack with the pop soundtrack of Huey Lewis, and there's some other people, and they have both 80s and 50s pop music on there, and both of those are fantastic. But then you think the other half of that is the score by Alan Silvestri, which anybody, you hear that theme and you know it's Back to the Future. And so that was another thing I was looking forward to. I was actually talking to a friend of mine right the day before, and I said, man, one of the things I'm most anticipating is hearing that Alan Silvestri score on the big screen again. And, like, when I heard it, I had the hairs on my arm stand up. I got the goose pimples, and I was just so excited to hear Alan Silvestri. That Back to the Future score is one of my he is my favorite non-John Williams person or composer of all time. Like, that's just, thinking about that music is so perfect for me with the composition of the music. I love that score. So
yeah, me too.
That was something that I was thinking about. And then just the juxtaposition of the two decades, the 80s and the 50s, for me. And you're jumping in the middle of both decades with the 55 and 85. And they're both so rich in history.
Right.
I just love it. And you know me, the 80s is my favorite decade of all time. And I remember as a kid not liking the first Back to the Future movie because of the 50s stuff. Because I as a kid, I always thought the 50s were boring. There were malt shops and...
Well, you didn't like Happy Days?
No, I didn't. Well, I liked the Fonz. I thought the Fonz was cool. But just the time period of the 50s, I always thought was lame. And The second, and the same way with the third movie, that was even going back even further. Yeah, yeah. Like, I was like, oh, cowboys? I was one of those kids who didn't like cowboys and Indians growing up. Like, I was like, that's old. But the second movie always appealed to me because it was futuristic, it was technology, right. And I've always been attracted to that. So that's why I always loved the second movie as a kid. But as I've grown older, the first one, to me, I think is the tightest movie. I don't think the second and the third ones have the same cohesiveness that this one does, and I think that there are a lot more problems with the second and the third one.
Yeah,
and yeah. This is the only movie in the series that I would say can exist on its own, and I feel like if 2 and 3 didn't exist, I still think Back to the Future would be one of the greatest movies of all time. Even, I mean, 2 and 3 kind of round it out and flesh it out and make it a trilogy and give us more that we love, but at the same time, I mean, I think you could say the same way for Star Wars. Like, Empire Strikes Back is still my favorite, and Return of the Jedi. Both of those are great movies, but even if just the fourth episode of Star Wars existed, I think that there's a reason why these two movies kicked off these franchises, because I think they are just so great. But
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, now I appreciate the 50s a lot more, and there are things like Mad Men that I watch on TV and other things where, for whatever reason, now I love the 50s. I love the music. I love the way people treated each other. Like, of course, I didn't live in the 50s, so I'm just going off of secondhand accounts. But
You wouldn't have liked the Red Scare, I don't think.
But I feel like, I'm sure there was things with segregation, and there's a lot of things I probably wouldn't liked about the 50s. No. But I like to look at the 50s as an optimistic time in American history where everything was, you know, there's a scene in Mad Men. I know you don't watch Mad Men, but there's a scene where they go and have a picnic. And then at the end, to throw their trash away, they just kind of just like pull the thing, the blanket they're sitting
blanket,
on.
Yeah.
Yeah. They just air it out and all the garbage just goes into the air and then they walk away. Like, they don't make any effort to put in the garbage can, but that was like I feel like that.
Yeah.
Right, that there the encompasses the time period. It was like, oh, it'll be okay. Just throw it out there. Like, everything was optimistic. The future, like, you look at those trade shows that they had about, we're going to have flying cars and we're going to, you know, the future is, there's a great, big, beautiful tomorrow.
Well, you see, now, my parents were 60s hippies, okay? And so they grew up in the 50s. And so while I was growing up, all I heard about was how the 50s was all about mind-controlling people, and the government is that big brother is out to get you, and, you know, like, how they scared the crap out of them as children because they would have, like the raids where they, you know, like, mm-hmm. What is it called? The fire drill type raids you know, the bombs are going to be dropped. Get under your desk, you know. So, you know, my parents, their generation, when they got to be teenagers and everything, they rebelled against that cookie cutter lifestyle, you know, where the Leave It to Beaver lifestyle. They rebelled against that. So when, like, I love Back to the Future. At the time I went to go see it when I was a kid, and like, I was already a teenager in the 80s, right? So that was my generation growing up. I was a teenager in the 80s, and so that was seeing that movie and then go back in time to his parents. That's how I felt, because that's how old my parents were in the 50s, you know, like it correlated, like, my life and theirs. Like, it definitely correlated. So when I saw that film, like, I thought about it. Like, I remember my dad telling me how in the 50s, you know, you couldn't have your hair showing past your neck. Mm-hmm. Like, you would get thrown out of school if a man's hair wasn't cropped, you know. Or, like, if you had your collar up, if you wore your collar up on your shirt or your jacket, you got thrown out of school, you know, like, things like that, like, all these restrictions from the 50s. And I was a fan of Happy Days. And so, I mean, my dad always talked to me a lot about things, how things were when he was growing up and everything. So that's why it really was, like, it was a really special movie to me, because I felt like, oh, I'm a teenager in the 80s. And if I went back in time to the 50s, I would meet my parents in high school, you know?
Yeah. But then you look at things like this, the high school that he goes to. This is another kind of I feel like the 80s or the 50s were cleaner than the 80s, both in the air quality and then just, you know, things being newer in the 50s. So that was, you look at the difference between his school in the 80s and his school in the 50s.
He was like, yeah, they really cleaned this place up, he said.
Yeah. Actually, that was kind of funny that that was one of the things that I was thinking about. I don't necessarily think it's a flaw, but I think Marty, a lot of times, he had selective amnesia where acted like he didn't remember. Like, okay, the scene where he had to push his dad out of the way. And it was like, we already saw earlier that they were so fed up with hearing that story. You feel like it would have been ingrained into their mind. Well, and
no, you know what? I think the opposite. It's like, you remember the Cynthia goes, yeah, you told us a million times already, the fish under the sea dance. And she's like, no, enchantment. Like, they've heard it so many times that they've blocked it out and they haven't retained any information. And not only that, I think he was surprised by the fact that, remember, just before that happens, he sees his dad up in the tree with the binoculars and he's like, he's a peeping Tom. You know, so I think that kind of, you know, threw him off. And then I guess, you know, he's about to get hit by a car. So he didn't know that that was his mother's house.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So. Yeah.
But I think you're giving the kids not too much credit, but you're like, if you've heard something so many times, I think if you heard it again, then your memory would automatically say, oh, wait, I remember that. Because he says, he was like, hey, wait a minute. They're supposed to go to this. Like,
yeah, yeah.
He remembers it. But it, like you said, it was, they didn't get the details right. But I feel like if they knew if these situations came up, I feel like it would jog something in their memory, so, or in Marty's memory. So there was a lot of times where I felt like he didn't quite use his information that he had in his head to his advantage. Right. But I still, another thing about this movie I was thinking about with the music. These were my original songs in my mind, like Earth Angel and Johnny B. Goode. Mm-hmm. Their versions were the originals to me because I never heard the original artist sing those songs before. So now I was actually doing it after I got home. I was like, man, I really love that rendition of Earth Angel. So I went on YouTube and I searched for Earth Angel and I was looking at different, and there was a couple acapella groups that I liked. But then I went back and listened to the original, the Penguins. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is not as good as the guy in Back to the Future. I like that guy. So,
well, I hope you don't like Johnny B. Goode better.
I do. I love it. I love it, love it, love it. Of course, that's not Michael J. Fox singing, but
no,
I grew up thinking that that was the original song. And so when I heard the Chuck Berry later, it's that, I think this is a weird psychological thing where a lot of times, whatever the first thing you experience is, that, for whatever reason, I think you like it more than if you see a remake of a movie or if you hear a song covered. A lot of times, you know, it brings you some type of joy because you love the original, but at the same time, it's like, well, they can't top the original or this isn't, you know, back in my day, it wasn't as good as...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so that's... Even when I'm hearing the cover song first, then I hear the original later. I've had that happen to me a number of times where I'm like, oh, wow, I really like this, whatever version I heard first. And I've had that with movies, too, where if I see a newer movie and then I go back and see the original that it was a remake of, I'm like, wait a minute, I like the one that I saw first. So I that's just a weird psychological thing for me, but I was really happy a couple of years ago when I found the soundtrack for Back to the Future, and it had both of those versions, the movie versions of Earth Angel and Johnny B. Goode, and their extended versions of the song. So I was actually dancing to both of those in my car on the way home after Back to the Future.
Nice.
So that's another reason that I love the movie is, again, we talked about it, the music.
Yeah. I feel like there's nothing not to like about this movie at all. It's just, I could watch it every day. I could go, you know, I mean, I think it cost about $30 to buy two tickets for me and my husband to go. Mm-hmm. And then we had to go into the city. So that was, you know, it wasn't at our local theater. And so we had to do that. So, you know, it was quite a bit of money to actually go see this movie, and we were laughing because we were like, wow, you know, we're spending all this money for a movie we have like 5 copies of already, and we've watched a million times. We could like act it out, but yet we still want to go see it in theater. Still, which, you know, it makes me feel good about movie theaters, because there was that time where I really thought no one was ever going to go to the movies ever again. Mm-hmm. Like, DVD had just taken over, and, you know, why go out to the theater and pay, you know, all this money when you could just sit home and watch it? And it's kind of nice that there's, a resurgence in theater going, because people, you know, like, people are sick of sitting home, I guess, and watching stuff. Like, they want to get out and see it on a big screen, you know, with digital projection and the surround sound and everything. So, it, you know, movie going is a great experience. So I'm glad it's still an option.
Yeah, it's weird because I never had that experience, or I didn't have that preference when I was growing up. And even up until this year, I think I preferred seeing movies at home because I thought I was in control of it. So if I want to pause it and go to the bathroom, I'm not going to miss anything, and I could watch it at my leisure. But now it's weird. This year I've seen more movies than I've seen than any other year in my life, probably, because just with what I've been doing through working with various websites and podcasts, I've seen not only like at least one movie a week in the theater, but then you count how many through Netflix and Hulu and, you know, all the other online and renting. I rent a lot of movies, so I think this year I've watched more movies than any other, and definitely in the theater I've watched more movies, and now I feel like you just can't get the same experience at home that you can in the theater, because unless you have a home theater you got a 100-inch screen, like I feel like you just can't equal the size of the screen or the sound system. As advanced as the home theater systems are with Blu-ray and with the 5.1 and now 7.1 surround sound, it's just not the same as a movie. And I feel like you're paying less for a movie than you would be to go out and invest in all of those different equipments. So anyways, that's something that I've found this year that's kind of different with me. I wanted to touch on something real quick. Mm-hmm. Going back to one of the elements I was talking about that I think make up this film, the acting, and Michael J. Fox and Crispin Glover and Thomas Wilson as Biff and Christopher Lloyd as Doc. And it was really, I don't know, this time, I think it was, again, watching in the theater, I was hyper-focused on it this time, but the nuances of the movie really stood out to me this time, mm-hmm. whereas a lot of the more subtle things stood out to me this time, where in the past I may have glossed over a certain look that Christopher Lloyd made or just mannerisms. I think Leah Thompson as the young Lorraine this time really affected me for some reason, because I think she was that. And I was going to get into this earlier when we were talking about the 50s, but I kind of got off track. Mm-hmm. But I think our vision of the 50s is most likely skewered than what actually happened in the 50s. Like, I feel like we think that everybody was so
perfect and everything. Yeah.
They
well-mannered.
Yeah. And nobody, you know, nobody
smoked parked, or drank, right? Yeah,
or, you know, had relations before marriage or anything else. But, like, you can see in Lorraine's character, like, she, I think that's more of what, like, these are still human beings in the 50s, even though I feel like there were things that the level of offensiveness, the threshold of offensive things, you see that in music and pop culture now. We're able to swear a lot more and get away with a lot more things. I think the level of that was a lot lower or higher back then. But at the same time, I feel like there were still people, and they were still human beings, and they still had urges, and they still, you know,
it just wasn't out in the open.
Yeah. Like, you could see it in the way they dress. They're, you know, a lot less skin was shown with the ladies, but the way that she was lusting after her son, Marty, that it's uncomfortable, but at the same time, it's so funny in the uncomfortableness. So that's kind of what I loved about her performance of the shy girl, but at the same time, like, really aggressive. Like, those two characteristics juxtaposing each other was something that I loved her performance in this. Actually, I loved all the performances. The crazy paranoia of Doc, the coolness of Marty, but at the same time, he exuded confidence, but he didn't know what was going on a lot of the time, and he was in a foreign situation and out of his element in the 50s, you know, whereas in the 80s he would be, you know, it was that thing of the difference between him and George was confidence. And
right,
you know, they were like, well, what did your mother ever see in him? And maybe you're not related. And it was the biggest difference was confidence. And then we saw at the end, the new George in the 80s, he actually had that confidence and was a totally different guy. But I feel like that was what was the difference between Marty in the 80s and Marty in the 50s, was that he still had that confidence, but he didn't quite know what was going on, and he didn't know how to open a bottle, and he didn't know, you know, what people wore in the 50s. So that all of that stuff was great. And I was thinking about Crispin Glover, who this was the only Back to the Future film he was in, and he's been described as very unusual just as a person. And I think in this movie, now that I went back and kind of hyper-focused on it, I feel like he is a lot more of that George McFly character than we thought originally. I think it's like those actors like Tom Cruise or Will Smith, they kind of play themselves in every movie.
Right.
I feel like Crispin Glover as the young George McFly, that I think that is his personality. He's like a strange guy like that,
right,
just like George. So a lot of times I think we were crediting him as being just a great actor, but I feel like knowing more about his personality now, and a couple of years ago I got a chance to actually see him in person because he was taking a film that he directed around with him, and it was the strangest film I've ever seen in my life.
Really?
It's one of those movies that it's so full of avant-garde and symbolism that it just doesn't make any sense, but they're like, okay, yeah, this is my art form here, and this is what I was trying to say here and here. But when you watch it, like, you have no idea what's going on. Like, from one moment to the next, it makes no sense. But I feel like that is who he is as a person. And there's a famous clip of him on Letterman. If you go on YouTube and just search Crispin Glover on Letterman, it's bound to come up, where it was like the Joaquin Phoenix interview, although Joaquin Phoenix was playing a character. Like, it's just the strangest interview. So, yeah, I think watching it this time, Crispin Glover is much closer to Marty or to George McFly than I originally thought.
Right.
So that was just an observation that I was thinking of. And just Tom Wilson, the perfect bully as Biff, like that, his performance as Biff is amazing to me. And again, now with the knowledge of time and getting to know the actors a little bit, you know, I don't know him personally, but Tom Wilson, he's a very nice, like the opposite of Biff. So I felt like that just made his performance that much better, because you believe he's this menacing guy who will just, you know, totally destroy your life if you're a George type person.
Right.
So I wanted to know, actually, Eve, you saw it originally in the theater. Mm-hmm. What was your reaction to both? This all comes in the same scene, the Star Trek, the Star Wars, and the Van Halen together.
You know, I think that solidified this movie to go right to the top 10, right there. You got some of my favorite things. First of all, when I saw the tape that said Edward Van Halen on it, I totally like went nuts, because I was like I still am a major Van Halen fan, but I was a major, major Van Halen fan back in 1985. And that was right after they came out with, like, what was their most popular album at the time, which was 1984. And yeah, so that was like awesome. So yeah, when he said he was Darth Vader from the planet Vulcan and he did the Vulcan salute, that was it. I was like, this is the best movie ever made. Ever made. Here it is.
Because yep. I thought about you when I saw that scene.
That was a trifecta right there.
Yeah.
Eve trifecta, definitely. So I think it's safe to say that this movie is the greatest and that it's definitely worth owning and watching many, many times. Also, I feel like even though I've seen this movie so many times, it's not funny. Every time I watch it, I catch something new. And it always amazes me because I'm like, how did I not know that? Or, you know, maybe I did know that 20 years ago, but now all of a sudden it's like, I'm remembering.
Well, that's another thing that leads back to the tight and the density of the movie. I'm your density. The density of the movie and the tightness of the movie for me is that they planned it out so meticulously. Like you said earlier, everything you see in the beginning, it comes back in a way that your first viewing, you don't quite catch everything. But then with the second and the third view, that's what makes it great, is Back to the Future, you can watch it so many times, so many years later, you can still pick up new things, and they planned all of that out. It wasn't just like a random occurrence. Like when you see the beginning is the Twin Pines Mall, and then he hits one of the pine trees, and then at the end, it's like the Lone Pine Mall.
Right, right.
So that things like that, like that's not an accident. Like they planned that from the beginning, and that's what I think really sets the first one apart from the second and the third ones, because there are a lot of things in the second and the third movies, even though those were shot together, so those are pretty, you know, they're pretty in sync with each other. But if you look at the difference between the first movie, which was in 85, and the second and the third movies, which came in 89, 90, there was that four-year gap where, and originally they didn't even know if they were going to do a sequel.
Right.
So there are things that they did not plan for, and it's pretty famous that they switched actresses between for Jennifer, the
right.
Marty's
right.
girlfriend, and they've, you know, I've watched so many special features and interviews. Bob Gale and Bob Zemeckis, the two guys who are the number one creative forces behind the series, they said if they knew they were going to do a second one, they wouldn't have put Jennifer in the car with them. Yeah, because
right.
they had to. Then when they were writing the sequel, they're like, oh, now what are we going to do with her? We have to drag her around. She's not really essential to the plot. So that's when they ended up kind of drugging her and throwing her in the corner.
Yeah,
but
lovely.
Yeah, like they were saying, and on the commentaries as well, they were saying it just. There were so many problems brought up by them bringing Jennifer in the car with them. So that's why I feel like the first one is the best, because it was so meticulously planned out, whereas the second and the third ones, they didn't quite know what they were going to do, and I think it kind of shows. So
yeah.
I mean, I still love the second and third movies, but not as much as I do the first film.
Right. Well, yeah, definitely worth owning, and I think getting on Blu-ray, right, Justin?
Yeah, I will be getting it, because not only is it going to be the best looking and sounding version of the film, but there are new documentaries, new footage. We already saw the Eric Stoltz footage, which that came out earlier, and I was like, there's more that we haven't seen? Like, I thought when the DVD came out, that was everything, but there's
right.
more. So,
right.
yeah, it's just... There's just more. There's a new documentary that they put on there, and there's new interviews. Which, speaking of, that reminds me. Also, this kind of ties into the Scream Awards that we talked about earlier. It really breaks my heart to see Michael J. Fox now compared to
seeing
him as an, I don't know, 18, 19, 20-year-old guy, and he was at the peak of health, and he just looked so great. Like I can see how he was a heartthrob in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And now seeing him on the Scream Awards, where it's so hard for him to get a sentence out. Like,
and
Christopher Lloyd just looks like he's about to fall over and die, but that's just old age. But yeah, it hurts my heart when I see Michael J. Fox now.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Oh, and I was going to say, speaking of pain, but it's really more happiness. I had tears in my eyes for much of the film. And it wasn't because I was sad or, you know, I wasn't crying at any reason of that. I was so happy that I was watching this movie, and it really is my favorite movie of all time. And I just, there was so many moments that made me so happy that just, I was just, you know, I was so happy I was crying for much of the movie.
Right.
So that there are few movies that can elicit that kind of response from me, and that's when I know that I really find a movie special.
So Justin, why don't you tell our listeners once again where they can find us on the internet?
Well, they have to remember that everything is FLIX, Flicks of Doom, on Twitter. Email us, flicksofdoom@gmail.com, or search for us in iTunes, where you can subscribe and leave us a review.
Justin, what happens to us in the future? Do we become assholes or something?
Oh, no. Everything becomes fine. You and Dave turn out fine. It's your kids, Eve. Something's got to be done about your kids.
If I'm ready. I don't even know what I'm all right. Okay, we should wrap it up, man. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
1.2. Wait, I can't say it. I can't say it. 1.21 gigawatts! 1.21 gigawatts! Now you're supposed to say, what the hell is a gigawatt? Go ahead, roll it.